This week's podcast is brought to you by our brand new song, Real Life. Check it out on Spotify, Apple Music, and wherever else you're streaming.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Front Lounge podcast with Congos. Today we have special guest Jeff Olson.
Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
Jeff and I went to high school together and reconnected when he came on tour with us 2 years ago when Marlo and Logan weren't available. I reached out to a friend who suggested Jeff. And so for the past 2 years, he's been taking some pictures of us, also doing stuff of his own, not just following us around, helping us with bus call filming. He's an avid cyclist. What else? What else are you, Jeff? Introduce yourself.
I'm really bad at this.
Jeff is an actual photographer, not just our friend from high school. He shoots. He works a lot in Phoenix, and what's the name of the bike store that you're the kind of resident photographer for?
I work for a state bicycle company. They're headquartered out of Tempe, Arizona. So
there's a lot of kind of commercial photography that he's done. If you go look at his website or his Instagram, you can see some of the more artistic stuff that he's done. Very, very nice. And we actually brought him out here to LA. Because we wanted to do some photos for the new album, the new campaign, some proper setup press type shots, which he never gets a chance to do on tour because we're always running on and off stage or changing in the dressing room, and he only gets candids. So we wanted to give Jeff a chance to actually say, hey guys, shut the fuck up. Look at me. Let's do a photo.
Let's do one photo where you're not eating a Kind bar.
And when he's in town, Johnny Marlowe is the second best photographer in LA.
Who's Johnny Marlowe?
Exactly. Jeff's photos.
That you're only saying this because of his comment yesterday that I'm aware of Johnny.
Yeah, look at where Jeff's tempering a turf war.
Yeah, Marlowe messaged us.
I didn't get in the middle of it, okay?
Marlowe messaged us on Instagram on one of our stories, and he said, "Ooh, you better watch it, Jeff. You're dead man. LA is my town."
You can come over to my house and we can hang out.
Some of those photos that you took recently for State Bicycle were so good they almost convinced me to buy a bicycle. And I don't ride a bicycle. They just I was like, that looks like the life. Fun and looks like the life.
That melts me a little bit. Appreciate
that. I like the ones where they're riding by the highway and all that.
Out here that I did.
Oh, that was out here?
Yeah.
Oh, cool, yeah. With all the hard shadows and everything like that.
Jeff, talk into the mic so everybody can hear you.
Oh, hello. Sorry about that.
You can tell us all about shutter stops and whatever the fucking terminology is. I'll tell you about where to put the microphone.
I like that. You can combine two things.
Well, I'm proving my camera knowledge right there.
Yeah, I never do this. This is unfamiliar.
New territory.
Yeah. What have you been up to in Phoenix and... and wherever else you've been working or, just in general in life?
The last couple of weeks have actually been very eventful in my life. Not in a big deal sort of way, but I finally pulled the trigger on a camera I've wanted forever. It's a Leica M rangefinder and sort of like a coveted compact camera with the full frame sensor size. So you get really, really high quality, and the camera itself is very discreet and portable.
That's what you've been shooting us on lately.
Yeah, so this work out here was kind of the first big project I've shot with it. It's just been practicing at home before then, so I literally just got it. So a couple weeks ago.
I know when you showed it to us, you said how much easier your life would have been had you had this camera on tour with us.
Yeah.
Because Jeff's duties when he's been on the road with us have been so split that he's kind of running around like a madman shooting all the stuff for bus calls, so video that he's capturing with one of our cameras. And then he's lugging around, at the time it was your old Canon, which is a beast of a camera.
Yeah, and I don't use the zoom lenses as much as I'd like to find something that suited a better manual focus need, but I shoot, they're called prime lenses, which is a fixed single focal length lens. The zoom lenses carry a stepless variety of the prime lengths. So you get, wide all the way up to a longer telephoto sort of length in a zoom lens. But the the optical quality, the aperture opens wider on these prime lenses, just lend a better image quality to them. So I end up carrying around a ton of gear, even just for still cameras. So combined with the video gear, it was...
You're a little bit of a purist. Like, you're not a total purist because it's still a digital back to this camera. Like, you're not lugging around, you know, what's a gunpowder and shooting a flash like that. But that it was, it's been nice working with you in this way because it's the limitations of, you know, like you're saying, a fixed length lens forces us to say, well, we want to get closer. You got to move closer. Like, you have to do certain things that actually forces the photo to be different. It's been actually fun and interesting seeing how we think about that when we've been doing these shots.
You make it. I would say it forces more conscious decisions, surely.
Yeah, and I think that's why I like it, is you do have to make so many decisions, and I don't know, maybe that's just sort of an ideal, but I like calculation. I like thinking things over. I'm sort of like a preparedness freak that way, so...
I see the way you pack your bag. You know, we've spent so much time on tour together living in close quarters, and his bunk is always very organized, unlike some other people on the bus. It's all like, that's part of your character, and I think it goes into your work and goes into your art, which is kind of cool. It's definitely a different look from Marlo's photos and some of the other photographers we worked with. And, you know, not to play favorites here, but we do like it. Like, we like the variety of photos that we've gotten from the different photographers, and yours has a certain crispness. And so I hope that comes across in the next photos that we start posting of yours. But just to go back to the bus life and the shit that you had to carry around, because we were doing three different things on that tour. We were having you get a lot of stills of us, so you had all your still photography gear. We had the bus call stuff, which was like this rig with all these microphones, so you had four or five microphones and the wireless packs, and they're all strapped to you. And then we had the music video that we were shooting on tour, which required a different camera. It was a big Black Magic camera, which had its own giant Pelican case. So every venue, you had to lug three cases in and a backpack, hook us up to the microphones every day. I mean, it was a shitload of work, you know, that, especially
that lost
tour. At
the time, too, I was sort of avoiding owning a laptop. I think the year before I was on a road trip and I lost a bunch of property in the back of somebody's car in San Francisco. There's just this amazingly well-executed car break-in. They're so good at it out there. But yeah, I lost my laptop. And then I prefer working on a sort of big screen iMac with it elevated above your lap. So yeah, anyways, I was avoiding...
Saving your balls, you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. But I resisted the laptop, so I got out to Chicago. It was the first date that I played with you guys,
we played.
We're playing for sure.
Yeah, tell us about.
I was working with
you
guys.
Got thrown right into the deep end, basically.
Yeah, and
you came on. You hadn't done much video work before, and all of a sudden, day one, we're like, "All right, so we're shooting a music video. We need still shots. We need live shots. We need candid shots. We need some behind the scenes stuff too, because we're shooting bus call."
And that's the day Logan.
And then you got to edit it all. And
Logan was leaving us that day.
Mm. Yeah,
so he was like, "Here, tell him how to do everything on the video, and
you know
see
what,
you later."
You know what I remember about that as not, or just in terms of when you meet a person, you know, you always have the first day or week or however long you have your impression of the person, and then you get to know them, and then you realize the distinction between your first impression and when what you got to know them as. That was so sped up because we were launched into a 12-hour workday.
Right.
And we started by going to get coffee to get everything going. And it basically forced all of the niceties and everything out of the way so that the first day I met you is exactly how I think of you now. You know what I mean? There was no like difference in impression to how you get to know a person. It was quite a weird thing. Because I've never really met a person where the circumstances forced you to just get over any kind of like normal greetings or familiarizing, you know.
So what did that feel like coming in on, you know, being thrown into all that?
Well, just to touch on kind of what Danny was talking about, I think that in a working setting, you get to know truly how like the inner workings of somebody, the essence of somebody's personality. there's little, I mean, there you can act and there are niceties and you kind of try to convey
actor,
your best self. But I stress the fuck out. And definitely in this work and in doing, like Johnny said, like three things at once, like there wasn't anything left in my mind to sort of like convey whatever personality I wanted to, you know, whether you do that in an unaware way or consciously.
Right, everybody had no energy to act.
Yeah. So I'm happy to know that you can live with whatever that first impression was.
Let's just check in with Colton from the top bunk real quick, because Colton was the newbie on tour on that tour until Jeff came in. So
Colton was my first point of contact too.
Oh, really? So yeah, let's hear about
your
memories.
He was the first of everyone that I met.
Well, when I first got to LA, you guys were in production. And at that point, I thought it was pretty cool. But it was kind of a roller coaster, you know. I got there and I was thinking it was going to be like super fun, you know, I was going to be able to like just check out how the whole, you know, situation was going to work out.
When he did the roller coaster motion, he just did a hand, but it only went down.
Yeah, it was a deep dive that first that first few days. I remember talking on the phone with my mom and being like, you know, I don't know if this was a good idea. Like I've been working outside all day. There's like 12-hour days, and you know, and it went uphill from there. You know, I think as soon as we got to around Spokane, I felt comfortable doing what I was doing.
Yeah, once you accept the work schedule and the workload, and it kind of becomes, okay, well, this is what life is, then you can really start to enjoy it. Yeah.
Well, just a refresher for the listeners, Colton Czar, he did merch for us on the last few tours. He's also hosted our VIP, so if you bought VIP tickets, he was kind of ushering you in with Mo. And
for that one fan who doesn't know him as Colton, it's Galahad.
Oh, yeah, Galahad, yeah. But Colton became known as, he had a lot of nicknames. One of them is Colton from the top bunk, because he had the top bunk on the passenger side front. And right now he's out in L.A. just helping us with social media and all kinds of stuff and shipping merch. And so he's a good point of contact. But what Jeff was saying is, you're saying Colton was the first person you met when you came on tour?
Yeah, I mean, I got dropped off in front of the venue, and whether I knocked on the door or... Oh, yeah, I think Jason was who I was corresponding with, and I talked to him on the phone maybe a couple times, but I called him as soon as I got there, and then I think he kind of ushered you up, because you were working on merch, you were at the front.
Right, that was just a big venue with a lot of things going on.
Did Colton try and haze you? Like, now that he was the tour veteran, he's like, I'm going to show this fucker.
I've been doing this for 3 weeks.
Everybody definitely, you know, with regard to first impression stuff, everybody was like the warmest and like the most welcoming. It was really nice, actually. Like, come on and join the show here. it was very exciting. It was overwhelming, too. I had no idea what I was in for, as much as Dylan sort of like verbally groomed me to get out there, you know, 16-hour days and late nights, working all day, the gear. Definitely communicated that it was going to be difficult, but I had no idea how difficult it was going to be to work on tour. And especially, I mean, in a content sort of generation or document job, you're working even when people are breaking.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah,
like you're working until you go to sleep.
A lot of times crew guys look down on or think of like the photographer as having the cushy job, but not in your case.
Not with us.
Yeah.
Not just the photographer. Yeah.
Well, I need 100 pictures of me every day.
It's one of the things we're trying to capture on Bus Call. And, you know, through your footage, Jeff, we really did get a look at ourselves, and we got a look at the whole thing in a different way, because you were so diligent about keeping the camera on. You know, at first, Logan, like everyone kind of instructed you on what to do, and then at a certain point, you just kind of found your own rhythm. And the good thing about it was that we became so comfortable with you, and also so comfortable with the camera, because it's almost like it didn't exist, you know, because of your presence and the way you kind of handled it. Well, so we got some good shit. We got a lot of good behind the scenes footage where it truly was candid, because we've kind of forgot the camera was there. But that whole idea of you just jumping into this world and then literally you slept 18 inches above me on a fucking bunk bed. And that's our first, I'd never met you. So, but to go from that, like, hey, nice to meet you. You're going to take photos of us. And then night. I could reach up and grab you.
Most people's dating life is a lot slower and more relaxed.
I mean, 12 dudes cannot get more intimate than bus life, I don't think.
I definitely sure feel like.
it's not what this podcast is about.
Just from, like, I guess fundamentally shooting or photographing people, I feel like to do it well, to photograph really anything, you have to have a good familiarity with your subject. And I didn't know any of you guys. So knowing what would be interesting to capture, what is normal for you to do throughout the day, what is unconventional behavior, what's exciting, what's dramatic. I had to learn it, you know, as I went. And you pick it up pretty fast living with them and spending 16 hours of the day with them and then sleeping above Jesse.
I think that my favorite photography outside of, you know, like outside of this stuff, just photography in general, is that. I like all the photographers that go live in a situation. Mm. Like that's all the dudes I like, is they go out somewhere and they live in a place and they live amongst the thing that they're photographing for at least a month or whatever, you know.
Hey guys, this week we are running a special on our store. It's 35% off store-wide for podcast listeners only. Go to store.congas.com and check out some of the new merch we have, including some limited edition posters. The code is all capital letters, THEFRONTLOUNGE35. That is the numbers 35, no spaces. Again, it's THEFRONTLOUNGE35.
Why don't we get into that a bit? Because you guys were just talking about some of your favorite photographers. I don't really know photographers, but I follow this guy on Instagram, Steve McCurry.
Yeah.
Steve McCurry, the National Geographic guy, that's what he's kind of most known for. And that's, you get the impression that when he shoots a picture of some scene in Vietnam or in, you know, in Africa somewhere, it doesn't seem like a tourist, like, hey, that's cool.
No, yeah.
You know, you feel like he's been there for months, really seeing what makes that scene work. So
yeah.
Who you
even
guys
when
been?
He stages, like he stages photos, or doesn't stage them, but if he's going to take a picture of somebody, he'll go and ask them to be in the picture.
Yeah,
and
no, he styles it for sure.
Right. He kind of like sets it up a little bit, but then the end result is a way better impression of the scene than if he had done it purely candidly.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your guy or girl?
The guy is, I would say, Henri Cartier-Bresson is like my MJ, sort of like GOAT.
Are we talking about Michael Jackson or Michael Jordan?
Michael Jackson as the photographer. Michael Jordan. Yeah, I don't know. Like, you know, you can compare LeBron James and Kevin Durant to Michael Jordan, but you watch the guy play and there is a attitude and a finesse and there's just something special that's not duplicated. And
yeah, I agree about Jordan and about Bresson. That's weird to me that, like, the scenes, like my favorite Bresson pictures are those. Where is that in the kind of war-torn? Is it Italy or somewhere like that with those kids?
I should know. I think he shot in. I know most of his, or I think most of his, like, photojournalism work was in China, but that looks like it's more in like Turkey or like Eastern Europe, maybe somewhere.
I mean, it's not stuff you haven't seen before in terms of photographs, but
content-wise,
right? Right. But there's something about his stuff that's special.
What was special about him as a photographer, and he actually coined this this term and this idea. It's truly to me the merit in photography. If photography's art at all, is the decisive moment. And the decisive moment is I guess, like an intersection in time. It's this surreal moment that encompasses the event that you're capturing. So, I mean, a frame of a photo is an event. It's a snapshot in time.
Is it, you know, the term synecdoche? We were just talking about this movie. Synecdoche, it means like when the part represents the whole. And the whole represents the part.
Yeah, that's,
you know, they
that's
use
a really
it,
good parallel.
Like New York means New York City and New York and so on, or
The White House means the government.
Right, yeah.
It's America.
The Kremlin means the Russian government and so on. Or like a crystal, you know. Like if you at the microscopic level, it resembles the large crystal. I feel like if there is a decisive moment, is that you can picture a lot more than just that frame. It gives you more information than just one frame.
And when people say like a picture's worth a thousand words, like poetic words, like you can look at this, you flip through pictures at few a second, and then. I feel like a picture that is captured in this decisive moment. It stops you, and your eyes are moving around the frame. It's clear to you why the picture was taken. It's cogent that way. Pictures can look really pretty, and you'll sit there maybe with a friend that takes pictures, and you'll ask them why they took it. But there's just something surreal or magical.
Let me ask this question. When you say the decisive moment, have you, when you've been shooting, known when you took the photo that moment occurred? Or is it something that you often discover afterwards looking through your selected photos that you realize the moment occurred?
I guess both. But for me, it happens so infrequently. I couldn't even tell you a picture. There is a picture that was actually accidental. That and Henri Cartier-Bresson definitely spoke about what gives you that sort of that gift or talent to take these pictures is simply a sensitivity, and you do have to have an eye and a mind for form and geometry and how to compose a picture. But really, it boils down to sensitive people that can see what's going on. I mean, you're looking through a little viewfinder window or through the lens, and I'm so distracted. Like I want to make it, look superficially pretty, but there is seeing beyond that. And truly, I guess I'm at a loss for word about it, but you're seeing what's going on. Like you have a feeling
that the decisive moment, if there is such a thing, happens well before the moment, as in there is like you're seeing the culmination of every cumulative decision that a person has made up until that point, which is they've decided what should be in it, what's important before all that, what the what kind of contradictions are captured between the foreground and the background and everything leading up to some moment. So it feels like a moment, but clearly it was maybe the half an hour before that, or the fact that they even chose this place and everything like that,
That's pretty, intuitive of you, because it'd be interesting to see a lot of these photographers' contact sheets a lot of the photographers I like, their analog work looks completely different than the digital, but yeah, to see like how many rolls of film that they shot to get this one type of thing.
Steve McCurry is a good example. I don't know if it's just the medium. I don't think it is. Maybe it's the way that it changes the way you shoot, or maybe the fact that he got older, or maybe just everything loses its luster. But his film stuff is way better than his digital stuff, I think.
I think that has to do with the way that...
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to touch on a lot of these great photographers that were shooting color were shooting a slide film called Kodachrome. And it was, I think it was one of the earlier color films available, but... its processing required different chemicals and a much different or much more complex development process. And in turn, it rendered life in color like no other film emulsion has, and definitely no digital camera can. And I think Steve McCurry's got even a little like short video about like his last roll of Kodachrome. And he shoots Robert De Niro in New York. He went back out to... I forget that Afghan girl that's wearing like the red robe and the green background. He may have gone back out to that location and shot a portrait. But yeah, there is magic in that specific film, and a lot of the photographers that shot it will agree. A lot of them, either stopped shooting or they stopped shooting, really great looking pictures after that. But film itself had a lot to do with their work.
There's a movie on Netflix called Kodachrome about
Oh, really?
The lost day that the factory is going to be processing the film.
Is that the one with Ed Harris?
Yeah, Ed Sheeran. yeah, it's with Ed Harris and I forget who else. It's pretty decent.
The Marvin
movie,
Gaye
yeah.
Estate is suing Ed Harris for having the same name as Ed Sheeran.
They're getting out of control.
Yeah, before we move on, I want to go back to the LeBron MJ argument, because like that is the most popular sports argument. We're not even sports guys, and I feel like I'm part of that discussion, you know, just because it's such a it is such a discussion of when you have this person who was like a magical moment in time, Michael Jordan, and the skill and everything that came together to create this perfect sort of essence of basketball, you know, and now you have LeBron James, who arguably a lot of people saying is better. And if they played each other today, who would win, that kind of stuff. But I think to relate it to your idea of a decisive moment, I think one thing that I got out of what you're saying is that you can't control the circumstances in the world. You can't control when something's going to happen or when things are going to collide. And Michael Jordan just happened to collide at the time where basketball was like the best thing in the world. I remember at that age just thinking it was the best sport. It really was like an apex, and all these different circumstances collided to make this magical player in this magical time of basketball. And that happens in a microcosm on any time you take a photo. All these uncontrollable circumstances colliding in the world in time, and then you, your sensitivity, your ability to observe these things and then click the button at the exact right time, you know, that is how I picture the decisive moment. And I'm not a photographer, but you kind of know it when you see it, and it's in any form of art. When somebody's able to pluck that time out of that piece out of time and put it on a recording, whether it's a film or it's, you know, audio recording or any other type of mechanism to put this art down into something permanent. And so that's the kind of thing that I like to talk about in art and photography. The decisive moment is a very good term, I think, but I think that term exists in any form of art.
Maybe it's I've had a similar thought along the lines of recording, is that it's not even necessarily the medium or the finished product, but occasionally a picture or a recording acts as a bookmark to that event itself in time that occurred. You know, like, because you can listen, we've talked about this before, I think, but you listen to a shitty MP3 version of, you know, a great, whatever, James Brown recording or Ray Charles or something like that, and you're missing everything that was recorded in terms of the actual, you know, grooves that were made in a vinyl or the tape that was used or anything. And yet it still captures, it seems, the essence of what was there. So, you know, maybe there's some
intention,
but it's that there's got to be something beyond the physical medium that's captured there. And there is some reference in the universe or whatever you want to call it to that moment.
Maybe, I mean, I'm not opposed to the idea, but at the same time, if you took a great book you like and you dusted it a bit or got rid of some of the words and everything like that, and you got rid of enough information that it was what's the word? What's it, like, destroyed a bit, but you could still read it, then the content is beyond the thing, obviously.
Yeah, it's. I'm not saying it's one or the other. And obviously,
your brain is taking in a pattern.
Yeah,
and it's the pattern that counts, right?
Yeah.
So if you can deduce the pattern from enough information, then you get the emotion from the pattern.
Right. I'm saying that MP3 is effectively like cutting out a bunch of words, and
so you still get the overall pattern.
Yeah.
It's a pixelated version of the thing.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like we don't have to do the deep thoughts section now. We did. I had a shitload of deep thoughts
here. Let's talk about two of these guys you showed me on Magnum photo. Magnum photographers are, it's just like a little weird society, right? Where it's non-commercial photographers.
I think HCB, or Henry Carty Bazin,
started
it. He may have been one of like the founding members. I don't know enough about the committee, but it's almost like I can't think of like a record label or like a musicians committee, or I guess I'm not like involved in the art world enough to know like where you could go for various art forms, like to know all of these committee members are going to show
you
something. You
know what this is
like?
It's like ECM Records. ECM was a jazz label, and obviously they sold records, so there was a commercial element to it.
Mm-hmm.
but pretty much the guy was just, he had his standards and he was not doing it for commercial reasons. And a lot of our favorite jazz records are on that label.
Cool.
You know, and it feels like the same principle as Magnum photos.
Yeah, Manfred Eicher that started ECM Records, that's the one place I feel like you can use the word curator and not be a total douche.
This is, Magnum feels the same way. Yeah, they picked only, like there's zero commercial stuff on there.
If you follow them on Instagram, there's maybe a couple times a year, maybe once a year, I think their photographers are all maybe obligated to sell, it's called their square print sale. They sell like a small 6x6 or a small print that's signed by the photographer for $100.
I mean that the photography is never for sale.
No, right? No way. Yeah. But I think that there's some...
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with selling prints, obviously.
For sure,
yeah.
No.
Before we move on to the music only section, let's check back in with Colton from the top bunk.
Well, I like how he left Henry blank, blank, blank for... He was writing down what was we were talking about there to put it up on the website, and he just left it as Henry blank.
I do that a lot.
You spell it...
He also wrote Henry with an I. Jeff is Michael Jordan.
So how...
Photoshop your face over his doing the...
His free throw dunk. Honored and flattered.
How's life... been out here these last few weeks in LA? You've been hiking?
Good. I have my dog Blue out here.
Talking to the microphone.
He's pretty active. So we try and wake up in the morning pretty early before everyone else and get in about an hour hike in. And
you got a Runyon?
Yeah, Runyon. And he runs the whole thing. I think that's why they call it that.
Have you got an agent yet? I feel like if you hike Runyon, you're like bound to get an agent.
Yeah, I'm mostly
Blue's gonna get an agent.
Yeah. Yeah, Blue needs the agent, not me.
This dog's gonna make me some money if it's the last thing I do.
You know, whenever I see Blue, I think of a champion because he just feels like a champion to me.
Yeah, he's a winner.
Yeah,
and do you feel
like his dad?
Do you feel like you're becoming an LA douchebag? At what rate are you becoming an LA douchebag?
I don't think it's happening. I'm very conscious about it, too.
It sounds like something an L.A. douchebag would say.
People here are so fake.
I know, they're not aware of it. But,
first stage is denial. All right, cool. So let's move on to the music section.
Wait, can we just go and spring up these two guys before we go on Magnum Photos? The two guys that stood out to me is that guy, the Czechoslovakian guy, right? What's his name?
His name is Josef Kudelka.
Joseph Kudelka. Well,
I mean he's really great. He's fucking amazing. But the other guy is almost like on the level of Henri Cartier-Bresson.
Who's the other guy?
Alex Webb. So Henri Cartier-Bresson, his whole career, he actually shot with this. He's the reason why I initially was drawn to the rangefinder, the Leica system. But shot his whole career mostly on even just a single focal length lens, just a 50mm, and all of it was black and white. But this photographer, Alex Webb, definitely embodies that decisive moment approach. His moments are incredible, but he shot a lot of his career on the Kodachrome film we just talked about. So there's a book he made that's about 30 years of his work called The Suffering of Light. And I would say, like, if I could own one book, photography book, it's that one. It's The Suffering of Light by Alex Webb. Everybody should take a look at this book.
Yeah.
It's on Magnum's website. So just search Suffering of Light by Alex Webb on Magnum.
His
it's about 120 pictures.
His name doesn't lend itself to fame, though, nearly as well as Henri Cartier-Bresson.
You think
Alex
so?
Webb is more like the Spud Webb of photography.
You know what? Yeah, there is something like informal or like just... I don't know.
Unassuming.
Kitschy or something.
Do you have a middle
three
name?
French name makes you sound instantly like a better photographer.
Definitely.
Yeah. But he's amazing, this Alex Webb guy.
What's your middle name, Jeff?
Michael. Miguel, actually. No, it's Michael. My dad's name is Michael Jeffrey Olson. Jeffrey is his mother's maiden name. Yeah, so Jeffrey's a family name, so...
So Jeffrey Michael Olson.
That's it.
That's
yeah.
how you should go.
Because
oh,
you that's
think
your,
so?
Your Instagram is Jeffrey Molson.
Yeah. My last name is commonly misinterpreted as Molson, which has a nice ring to it, too. But yeah, I am Jeffrey M. Olson.
Jeffrey Michael Olsen. All right, cool. I think it sounds, you know, anytime you can do the what double
are you,
barrel name.
And who are, what are you doing here?
I don't know today, actually.
Music only. Jesse brought up a song, Leonard Cohen, Famous Blue Raincoat.
Yeah, I've been really into this TV show called I'm Dying Up Here lately, and they're on season two. It's on Showtime. It's sort of loosely based on the Comedy Store and the owner of the Comedy Store and all these comics in the 70s, and you know, it's just, I just think it's one of the best shows on TV right now. It's gotten better each episode and each season. But one thing I've always noticed over the last few episodes is the music choice is so good. And they ended this one episode with this Leonard Cohen song. I'm a Leonard Cohen fan, but I didn't know this song in this context. And I went and Shazammed it and looked it up. And I don't know if I'm connecting to the song more because of the scene that it was used in or just the song itself. But either way, it's just Leonard Cohen's one of those guys who can sing out of tune and it sounds perfect, you know.
Yeah, that I've been watching that show also. The guy, whoever's doing the supervision on that, really is picking the music perfectly correctly. Sometimes you get someone that picks a song for a scene, it just seems like they like pick a lyric, you know, like, oh, this scene's about bikes, let's have them talking about riding fast or something. But he really seems to capture the deeper emotion of connecting the music to a song.
Yeah, I always like Scorsese does this. I don't know who he uses for supervision or if he does it himself or whatever, but he always does super weird contradictions with his music. You know, he'll take the most insane scene in the movie and do something very psychedelic. He won't do the traditional kind of slow motion music or very chill, you know, where he emphasizes the contradiction quite literally. He'll do some weird take on it, and it really fucking works. Like, there's a great scene in Wolf of Wall Street where they start having that party in the office, and he uses some psychedelic 60s track. I can't even remember what it was, but it was a perfect use of music and exactly the opposite direction that I would have thought to go if I was doing it.
Well, you get the sense from Scorsese that he's very musical in all of his choices.
Yeah,
in
he
his
never...
editing. You know, he was the director of The Lost Waltz, which is the famous documentary or live concert show about the band
and the Stones one, right? Or the new,
yeah. And then he also did the most recent George Harrison thing,
right,
I
yeah.
believe. So like, he's obviously deeply connected to music, and it comes across in all his editing and supervision.
And he never uses, if he's whatever era the movie's taking place in, he never uses music that came out after that.
Yeah.
So it all kind of feels right.
Another
Island had so much classical music in it.
Right. Because he doesn't, it's just one of his little principles, I guess, is to not use like, you know, Blue Monday by New Order in his
well, if you look
period
at,
piece.
If you look at Casino, which is, you know, this really bright colored thing where cinematography on that movie is insane. I've heard people that know more about this say like what he achieved there just technically shooting in a casino is apparently a nightmare. You know, not just because you're losing money, but he uses St. Matthew's Passion by Bach in there, where it's so completely inappropriate. You know, it's this deeply religious thing from the 1600s, and you've got Robert De Niro in like a baby blue suit with like wingspan, what are they called, cuffs and all that. You know,
yeah. Just,
I think another good example of that is Unstrung Heroes. This movie from the 90s, directed by Diane Keaton.
I fucking love that movie.
It's one of the best movies ever made. I just looked it up now. It's
one of the most unseen movies.
Yeah.
Ever. Yeah. It's an
unsung hero.
Oh my gosh,
that's such a good Los Angeles movie too.
It's one of the best movies ever made. I just looked it up. It's got
6.7.
It's got 6.7 out of 10 on IMDb, and I'm like dumbfounded.
Not suitable.
It should have a 9.8.
Dude, Rotten Tomatoes,
high bouncer.
IMDb is number one manipulated, and Rotten Tomatoes is bullshit.
They're like, this is not as good as Thor.
Well,
even though Thor was really good. Ragnarok
was
great.
The music reference I was going to bring up was it's a very emotional and kind of sad movie, but it's got John Turturro and Andy McDowell and you know, some other people, but
Kramer's in it.
Yeah, that's right. But there's a scene I won't spoil it if you're going to go watch it, but there's a scene that's quite kind of a sad, emotional scene, and they play Ray Charles' "You Are My Sunshine," and the pain of that. It's, you know, you think of it as a happy song, but the pain of that song comes out in that moment.
But Ray Charles also did that consciously.
Yeah,
because the song itself is really sad.
I think it. Yeah, but you might not notice that unless you had an association, and this magically puts these contradictory emotions together.
Well, I didn't notice it because I don't listen to I listen to the sound of lyrics, but I often don't really listen to the content of lyrics until like the 10th time around, you know? And I never really listened to the content of "You Are My Sunshine," which is you were my sunshine, but then you died or you left, or is what the song really is. But I think it's died.
Yeah, Danny and I went to where the uncles live in that movie.
What building is that?
It's the King Edward Hotel in downtown LA, and there's a dive bar underneath it called King Eddie, and it's the most divey dive bar I've ever seen.
Oh, that's where the hoarders live in the movie?
Yeah, where the uncle hoarders live is up in that hotel, and there's a dive bar you can go check out there.
That kid actor, too. I don't know who that was.
Call me Franz or call me nothing.
It's basically a perfect movie, I think. And, you know,
I want to talk to you.
Hats off to Diane Keaton, because like that doesn't happen by accident, that kind of movie, I don't think.
Not at all, yeah.
Well, I guess we'll transition into the music business segment of this. We would just carry on this talking about music supervision as an idea. You know, the person whose job it is to... It's not just the selection of music from an artistic standpoint. A big part of that job, I think, is just clearing licenses, because it's quite a legal minefield. If you imagine a 2-hour film and you're wanting to clear 15 songs and the usages, you got to talk to everyone's publisher. You got to get approvals from artists, from publishers, from record companies. So it's a very, very important job. And also then those people are now some of the most targeted people in terms of trying to like gain influence. You know, if you get your song on it, at the time there was, forget the guy's name, but he was doing like True Blood, Sons of Anarchy, all these top TV shows, and like everyone was trying to, you know, get their song to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's one of those jobs. I feel like it is a very important job, and it's also, depending on the work or the show, it can be a totally meaningless, useless job. But it's one of those jobs where I hear a lot of people, you know, come to LA and they're looking for something to do. Like, what is my job? Am I going to be an actor? Am I a director, a writer? I don't know. Maybe I'll do music. I love music. I'll do music supervision. It's like, I'll tell you what song to put where in this show. And
it's like the DJ of the film world. Like,
it's the range of the skill. You could be useless and still get that job, or you could be in the case of Diane up here, I think, you know, somebody who truly understands music and emotion and story and writing, and it's a very important job. So I don't know, you know, I guess that's true.
Like,
for,
that's like
true for any job,
end.
You know, you can make gnocchi like Danny did
that
the
was,
other night.
It was better this morning. Last night was way too soft, and I was the last one to eat it. So I was thinking it was going to be better than it was, and then I ate my own dish, and I was like, oh, fuck. That kind of annoyed me.
Well, I got to take, I've been wanting to try this, is I took some of Danny's gnocchi dough, which is basically, it's potatoes, flour, and an egg, and fried it in some olive oil, like flattened it out like a pancake style, and fried it, and it
like
wasn't quite right
is
yet.
Is it called a latke?
I think a latke is different, but I mean, it's like a potato pancake along those lines, but the little bit of flour and egg combination makes this really soft thing, so... That's my experiment for this week, is gnocchi dough, but done as like more of a tortilla.
Can we do gear
pancake
of the week as the gnocchi roller? Because that's what I made it again this morning, because I got my little gnocchi roller, which is just a little piece of wood with grooves in it. And then when you cut the gnocchi and roll it, then you roll it off this piece of wood with grooves, and you get the little dent in it with the rod, and then you get the grooves so it holds the sauce. And it's pretty cool. It also makes you realize... that Italy changed their priorities over the last 4,000 years.
Yeah.
Well, didn't
from ruling the entire world in the Roman Empire to making different shapes of pasta.
Yeah.
But didn't you told me that Mussolini, fascist dictator as he was,
tried to
ban pasta?
He tried to ban pasta and I think he proposed it, you know, banning pasta and enforcing rice only, because he thought pasta made the population sluggish. I mean, he may, like, there's probably some paleo people out there who are, on board with Mussolini, but just kidding, paleo people.
That's probably the point that the whole country turned around. They're like, wait, what?
I mean,
fuck you.
they when they killed him, right, when they hung him and they cut his balls off and they put him in his mouth. That shows you what they thought of him.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't try and take away my fucking pasta.
Yeah. Or be a dictator.
That's
show
like,
you what
you
we'll
know,
do to you.
That's like going to England and saying, you know, you can't have fucking
terrible
baked
food.
Beans anymore.
Honestly, you could ban all the food in England and nobody would miss it.
I like that line. There's a line in that show, Goliath, where he's like talking about London and Billy Bob Thornton, and they're saying something like, they keep saying the food's getting better. They've been saying it for 30 fucking years. The food is not better in London.
The food is good in London if you go to like an Indian restaurant or a Lebanese restaurant or something. Yeah. So let's jump on to what. Oh, yeah. This is our remember when section. Jeff's.
You wanted to rename it.
Yeah. We're going to just talk about shit that happened in the past section.
We're dropping the name Member Berries and changing it to Thanks for the Memories. Yeah.
So Jeff has captured, I think, some of the best arguments between us brothers on the bus.
Flattered.
I think that goes to what Jesse was saying earlier. Like, we really did become super comfortable with Jeff there, and he was very much in the background. It was a little camera, and you didn't hear.
Let
from
me
him.
Touch on something with regard to very funny word. Irregardless, what Johnny Marlowe and Logan do so well is they are present with you. If you say that, you know, I can be around you and kind of somehow make the camera disappear. What I can't do that they do very well is they engage with you and they pull something out of you. And I'm kind of like a waiter. I am just like kind of like, yeah, like, I mean, the decisive moment sort of thing was like,
not
outside
in America.
Of my box.
In America, waiters like ask you immediately how things taste as soon as they bring it. How does it taste? Like,
I was waiting on
like
shit
a European
to happen,
waiter.
But it wasn't even like I guess within my skill set as I saw it to like demand and pull and ask for things out of you. So that is something that they do extremely well, and so maybe. If I was able to capture these arguments, it's because I was, you know, just lurking in the shadows.
Well, look, I think your point's right, because the show overall needed the different approaches. We needed sometimes to be coached along, or at least like interacted with. But then I think we've got some moments in the later part of the season, which, you know, hopefully was airing soon, that are really great, real moments that we watch back and go like, oh, I do not remember that having happened, really.
Or being filmed.
Or being there, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Like what? Can you dig one up right now?
Well, we don't want to go into too many details and give away too much about the show, but there are some elements that when you were out with us on this last run we did last year in May, in like in the middle of nowhere, in like Wyoming and Denver, and not Denver, it's not the middle of nowhere, but like in the middle of Wyoming and then Seattle. There's just some great moments that you captured that was really interesting and eye-opening for us to look back on and be able to watch back. Because it's great to watch back an argument.
Let's talk about the fact that we're very glad you decided to keep the camera rolling when Joey told you to turn it off. Told you to turn it off.
And apparently there was a moment when I did turn it off and...
Yeah, then you turned it back on.
Turned it back on, yeah.
Yeah. And you don't remember doing that. You must have just thought in the moment they're going to want this later, even if I have to say
yeah, that's must. Yeah, that's probably exactly what happened.
You clearly did it for our sake because you've signed an NDA, so there's no...
Well, I'm not like up in my bunk just like reviewing fucking Dylan doing laundry and stuff.
Jeff's private
stash.
Yeah,
no, I want to deliver the goods.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, when you see the episode, we watched a rough edit of it yesterday. You know, it's personal stuff, like arguments. Arguments are not strange to us at all as brothers, but having them filmed or having them on record, you know, that is strange to us. And it's one of those calls that you decided to make where it could have gone the other way. We're like, I can't fucking believe you turned the camera on, Jeff. You're fired, you know. But I think because you're, it was quite clear that your intention was correct. Like, they are going to want this. And in retrospect, we did. It made the scene work. And, you know, it's in the final episode of Bus Call. And, you know, I think people will connect to it. They'll connect to the realness of it.
The crew also agrees. You know, when we've watched some of the rough cuts and everything with the crew, a lot of them have always said, well, I don't even remember being filmed on that, when there was like some special moments between Garen and Mick and things like that. They're like, I didn't
you
realize
filmed
I was
that
being
shower?
Filmed. The only time I've seen it interferes with Jason, and it's not, and I can't attribute it to you. It's because Jason was dealing with 3 hours of American Airlines trying to change a fucking flight.
Yeah.
and then he's waiting
to find out about his baby and all this stuff, and Jeff was.
That's the only time, and it wasn't even your fault. It was American Airlines' fault.
Oh, you mean where Jason, where the kind of just said, all right, enough with the fucking camera. Yeah.
I've probably experienced a very broad spectrum of affection from Jason, because out of everybody, I think maybe Jason and Tyler have hated me the most for doing my job. And it's just because, like, they're people that are very busy and doing so many things at once. And so, like, wrapped up into their work while they're doing it. And it's sort of like the time when I can get or like expose what it is that they're doing.
I like to see the divided attitudes they get, because I can go to Tyler or Jason and say, hey, Jeff, we're going to have Jeff follow you guys around today, you know, maybe lob you up. And they'll be like, oh, totally, totally. And then as soon as you get there, like, oh, what the fuck are you doing?
I know. Yeah. I hate to be hated too.
What is it like being on the other end of an argument, like being in the room when we're arguing? You know, like sometimes when you see a fight on TV, or if you watch a boxing match, or if you're around in the room and someone else is getting shot. You ever remember when you were a kid and like your friend got shat on by their parents in front of you? Like their parents decided to really go at them in front of you, and you just feel very uncomfortable and feel your adrenaline rush. Do you get that like being around our fights?
When I have a camera on me? To be completely honest with you, it's take that Wyoming argument, for example. With the camera on me, it's like exhilarating. It's like it's like you come upon, you know, wildlife in Africa.
It's like you're watching a movie.
Yeah, it's like, oh, finally, this is my opportunity here.
The long-haired one is shouting at the short-haired one.
Oh my gosh, it was great. I felt like I was finally getting like worthwhile content for you guys. I mean, there was like an argument yesterday that I was just a bystander, and it's like, yeah, it's a bit uncomfortable just like watching your parents or your parents or something. If I was watching my siblings fight, I'd feel second nature to sort of chime in and say, you know, I don't know, say anything.
The weird part is when people are having an argument that you don't participate in.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like whether usually or not you have an opinion on what they're arguing.
Right, right.
I think the camera point, though, is kind of interesting because, you know, watching the way you work, especially with the bus call stuff, you've got to be, it's manual focus, you've got to be controlling the exposure, all these technical things that you have to worry about constantly. So you're spending your life, you're living through the viewfinder. Like, it almost never looks up because you've got to be constantly on that camera making sure it's being captured correctly. So that sort of, it's almost like you're watching reality TV in real life, in real time, you know, with this microsecond delay on the display. So you're watching this shit happen on a little screen. So I can see how it like doesn't feel real, and it could be entertaining if you just looked up from the screen, you'd be like, oh shit, this is going down. You know?
Jeff kept yelling cut. You want to retake that shot.
Yeah. It's kind of a choose your own adventure TV.
Oh, well,
call him a cunt now.
That'll work usually as a come on.
Yeah. This deep thought section we had, you know, we had the decisive moment in photography thing as that was the section, but you jumped the gun, you know, in the first segment, so you might not be invited back on the podcast. No, but I think we can actually talk
really
about
nice
that in something related to that is they've been doing all these neurological studies where they're seeing your brain light up up to 10 seconds before you make a decision. So when they're giving people an option in the lab to either to choose like one screen over the next, and they can see the choice happening 10 seconds before the person becomes conscious becomes conscious of their choice. So that I thought would be maybe an interesting way to kind of keep those ideas running, and like what this decisive moment is, like when Danny asked you, are you aware of it at the moment that you take the picture, or is it afterwards or in retrospect, or Johnny asked you? And is there a possibility to shorten that time frame of your mind already deciding to do something for you before you're conscious of it?
I think that's something that you probably practice for, maybe. Yeah. Like there's maybe like a talent in that. Like you, I think the sensitivity is a gift that you're born with, if you have it or you don't. But that, yeah, that logical sort of shortening in that window of time is probably something that you can achieve working on it.
Similar experiment is the coin flip. You know, when you have you think you have a equally divided preference, and if you flip a coin, it reveals your preference in the air often, you know, which to me is such a funny idea. It's like you had a preference the whole time, but you were somehow hiding your preference from yourself. That's a weird thing to do to yourself.
I use the coin flip. Rachel and I use the coin flip a lot, because by the end of the day, especially with a young child, you're out of energy for decisions. You no longer have decisions like what should we eat for dinner or what should we watch? And when you flip a coin, and you're right. A lot of times, the coin reveals that you did actually have a preference, you just didn't know it. And
how did you not know it? Is it because you want two things at once?
It's because becoming aware of it actually requires a certain amount of energy to consult your desire, basically.
It becomes reactive now because you've assigned some value or power to the falling coin. A different part of you, I think, kicks into gear, which is like emergency decision making. Like, because you've said, well, I need a decision by the time this coin lands.
Isn't that the thing where people lie less when they gotta pee? Or they're better at lying when they have to pee? Or they're something like that. Something improves when they have to pee.
I wonder if that's Donald Trump's secret.
I think that's different from what this study was saying. You know, that's some suppressing of a desire, and then like it revealing it to yourself, revealing itself to you when you're forced with the option of having to go with the opposite one.
Well, a similar study was the study where they would display images on a screen, and they were completely random, and some of them would be very disturbing or what arousing, or you know, that are guaranteed to create an emotional response. And they would be kind of changing through these pictures on the screen completely randomly at a random time. And so they were measuring people's brains while this was happening. And they found that when a disturbing or an emotionally kind of charged image came on screen, the person's brain reacted before the thing came on screen. Like, right. Without fail, where it was entirely... Oh, but it was different. It was either disturbing...
It was both. They were mixing arousing and disturbing. The study is contentious. It's the guy, that psychologist, Columbia... I can't remember his name, at Columbia. But, yeah, I mean, I buy it. I don't know if it's, like, my old age, now that I'm approaching 30, but I definitely am more open to... either some form of time not being linear or some aspect of life being timeless, because I've had a few experiences that's the only way I could explain them, is that they had to have existed not with my usual perception of time, you know.
Well, that in relation to photography is very interesting, because photography seems to be, you know, you capture a linear moment of time. Like, you can't, in normal reality, you can't go backwards and forwards. Like, that happened and it's on film and it's proven, you know. But it does make you question, let's say I have to do my Matthew McConaughey impression, does make you question the nature of reality, you know. Because time is a flat circle.
Well, I think that's why people
like... do high schoolers actually stay the same age or what?
That's, I think, why people like photography and any capturing of moments, even in the sound world. I think it's why people like delays and reverbs, because anything that's bending time and what you perceive as your normal just day-to-day existence, any change of that is novel or entertaining at the very least, and perhaps beyond that can be enlightening in the sense that it makes you or forces you to realize there is a subjectivity of time.
In relation to bus call, when you play on the recorder we use on the camera, when you plug in headphones, right, there's like a 30 millisecond, 40 millisecond delay. Does that fuck with your head or what?
I could not monitor the audio ever.
Because if you talk, you are hearing your own voice.
Yeah.
30, 40 seconds. And you can tolerate like maybe 10, 12 milliseconds before it starts to weird you out. And then 20 milliseconds, it ruins your thought, right?
This is a split second. Right. You know, 20 milliseconds, if you can clarify that, is a very, very small amount of time. Yeah.
Well, I mean, not to get technical here, guys, but it's more than that. You know,
what?
The delay is more than that. Yeah.
But I feel like you feel it at...
It's less than a second. It's a split second.
It's like a flam. It's like...
Yeah.
You know, I would say that's closer to 80 milliseconds.
Okay. Yeah, then it... Well...
Thanks, Jesse.
I mean, whenever I do tempos, I just do them in, you know, in tempo. I don't use milliseconds are hard.
That's...
Your brain cannot operate.
Tolerate.
Yeah, you can't work the same way.
Your brain expects to hear your voice when it expects to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you mess with that, it breaks your brain.
I think translators are people who translate live audio into another language is absolutely incredible.
Well, they must have some separation.
Yeah.
You mean that at the UN when they're listening to one language and talking a different... Yeah, that's insane.
The only time I've experienced that ability is truly was when, you know, I was high one time and I had this amazing ability to listen to a conversation and then actually go back, like you're on iTunes, you know, and you can scrub the player. So where you can get, you can change the part of the song that you listen to, like fast forward, rewind, whatever. It's like I was able to do that in real life. It's like my brain was recording the conversation and I could go back and replay it and actually hear it again. And it was very, very strange.
But could you go forward?
No, I could only go forward if I had already gone back. So like jumping back up to real time.
Okay, well, you're going to try this summer. Read, then. That allows you to go forward.
Jean-Claude Van Damme, in the movie Time Cop.
Have you guys, speaking of Jean-Claude Van Damme, he's got a show on Amazon Prime called Jean-Claude Van Johnson. And it's actually really fucking funny and good. It's very meta and self-aware.
Yeah.
About him, and he talks about how he's constantly going on about how Time Cop is way better than Looper with Bruce Willis. It's really fucking funny.
He made a movie called JCVD about him, right? Yeah, like saving a bank robbery or something, or helping in that.
But he plays himself.
Exactly. Right, yeah, it's meta that
Stop
way.
Stop right there. I could roundhouse kick you from a yard away.
But I heard it's an amazing movie.
What, JCVD?
Yeah.
It was pretty good. It's just funny that he's making fun of himself, you know.
Oh, it's good in that way?
Yeah. It was pretty good, yeah. I grew up liking, maybe I'm biased because I liked Jean-Claude Van Damme movies all entirely unironically for most of my life, so.
I think that's one. Everyone liked
him. He was a fucking
him.
Megastar. Yeah. I mean,
Bloodsport was one of the best movies ever.
His Volvo commercial, have you seen that?
No.
That's good. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I don't want to spoil too much. Everybody's got to see that. It's one of the most beautiful commercials ever. Enya is the soundtrack to it, but it's to display some like dynamic stability control in their semi-trucks.
Yeah, okay.
Best commercial ever.
All right, I'm going to...
Jean-Claude Van Damme, Volvo, get it.
On that note, Deep Thoughts comes to an end.
Let's end on Deep Splits, and this has been The Front Lounge with Jeffrey Molson and Colton Boulangerie.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for doing this podcast, and thanks for coming out and shooting these photos. We're excited for everyone to see the work that Jeff's been doing. He makes us look good occasionally when it's not too hard.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And we'll throw up all his socials and stuff online for you to follow him if he accepts you.
Conghost.com/podcast for all the links and info. Thank you for listening. Check in next week. We will be featuring new songs first on this podcast. So make sure you subscribe and follow us on all the interweb stuff. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Jeff. See you guys next time.